He said the legacy of Imam Khomeini still lives on several decades after his passing.
He has shown the world that Islam, which has governed the world in the old time, is capable of governing the world of our own time. He has also shown that the power is in the hand of the people. It is the duty of the people to rise up to change the situation in their places.
Members of the Academic Forum of the Islamic Movement said one of the basic lessons learned from Imam Khomeini is his stand against global oppression and arrogance. They said Imam Khomeini also emphasized Islamic unity and discouraged divisions in Islam. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
France's government has warned, don't expect inflation to return to normal until the end of 2023. At nearly 6%, French inflation is the highest since 1985, and the government says the peak won't even be reached until this winter. It's a stunningly serious diagnosis. Inflation has seemingly been the number one voter complaint since the euro currency was introduced in 1999, and now it's worse than ever. Many are pointing the finger at the pan-European project, with Brussels demanding austerity and forcing Paris to ignore mass protests and public opinion.
This inflation is a symptom of the profound crisis caused by the policies of neoliberalism put in place since the 1980s. Above all, the policies seek merely to enrich stockholders and create constant dividends. This inflation is going to last, and the government is only making a wild guess that it will end by 2024.
Across the EU, only Malta has managed to keep inflation lower. France has been saved by its constantly derided socialist-inspired measures, such as caps on energy prices. However, many are demanding more price caps, re-indexed pensions, immediate bonuses, higher wages across the board, and especially for low-wage workers, in order to keep inflation from making the poverty rate skyrocket.
All the countries of the European Union are basically already in a recession. The 2008 financial crisis was followed by a forced era of austerity, which created a structural lack of demand and investment in Europe. Making massive public investments with efforts to an ecological transition would create both jobs and demand for goods and possibly avoid another Great Depression.
80% of France says they're watching their expenses more carefully, which seems likely to push France's consumer-driven economy officially into a recession next quarter. 70% are distrustful of their economic future, which is record pessimism so soon after a presidential election. After all the austerity, the French are being told to expect nearly 2 years of widespread economic hardship. That may not only affect this month's legislative elections, but it could lead to major social unrest yet again. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
June the 2nd is the day Italy celebrates becoming a republic. On this day, in a referendum held in 1946, Italians opted to abolish the country's short-lived monarchy and adopt a republican form of government. Every year, the celebrations feature large military and official parades along the ancient Roman Forum in the presence of the highest offices of the state. Never before have controversies over the military parade been this contentious, with anti-war demonstrations held in a number of Italian cities, including Bologna, Padua, and Bari.
We are here to protest against the government's decision to send weapons to Ukraine and to stage a military parade on our Republic Day, while there is a war raging on in Europe.
One of the anti-war protests was held in central Rome, 500 meters away from the Republic Day celebrations. The initiative had been called by the base union USB and political party Power to the People.
Enough with military escalation in Ukraine, which is mainly in the interest of the US. Italy and the EU are not protecting people's interests. Most people don't want this war. We have to leave NATO, SAEP, and the Draghi government must go now.
Since the start of the Ukraine conflict, opinion polls have steadily shown over half of the Italians oppose sending weapons to Kyiv. and believes sanctions against Russia are useless. Protesters are angered not only over the Mario Draghi government's military spending on Ukraine, which they say would be better spent on raising workers' wages. They are also opposing the government's decision to raise military expenditure from 1.4 to 2% of the country's GDP.
This is a criminal choice. It's unbelievable. After years of slashing the welfare state, shame on the government.
I don't have anything against arms spending if weapons are used for defense purposes, not to fight proxy wars or to pillage other countries.
According to studies carried out by a number of Italy-based think tanks, Italians have never been eager to increase defense expenditures. Based on data from the 1950s, to date, on average, less than 20% of respondents believe that military spending is too low or should be increased. Max Civili, Rome.
Before Shaban Nasiri stepped on a Daesh explosive booty trap in Iraq 5 years ago, he had been barely known to the Iranian public as a pivotal military commander. But it's the fifth year in a row now that people in his hometown, Karaj, assembled on June the 2nd to pay tribute to the former commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, referring to him as a forerunner of the fight against terrorism and a flag bearer of security in the region.
During the Iraqi war on Iran in the 1980s, General Nasiri held key positions and offered valuable services to protecting Iran's soil. After the war, he did not sit on his laurels and rushed to the Iranian eastern borders to help fight drug smuggling. And finally, when he saw that the region was plunging into chaos triggered by Daesh terrorists, he went to Iraq and Syria to combat the terrorists, where he finally was martyred.
General Nasiri was a senior commander in the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps' overseas operation unit known as Quds Force. He was a key advisor to the then Quds Force commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated by the U.S. in Iraq in 2020. Nasiri stood shoulder to shoulder with General Soleimani in the fight against Daesh terrorists in Iraq and Syria. He was killed at the age of 59 during the liberation of the Iraqi city of Mosul from Daesh.
Shaban Nasiri played a key role in recapturing Mosul from Daesh. I was witness to his efforts there. Late General Soleimani likened him to martyr Jahanara, who liberated Iran's city of Khorramshahr from Iraqi forces in the 1980s Iran-Iraq war.
General Nasiri was a founding member of the IRGC, and especially the Ba'ath Brigade, formed in 1982 with the aim of fighting Iraqi forces during the Iran-Iraq War. The Ba'ath Brigade once again rose to prominence in 2014 during the fight against Daesh terrorists, when Iran offered advisory military support to Iraq's army.
Here, they call Shaban Nasiri a living martyr. They say they continue to remember his name as an anti-terror military commander who lost his life to let the people of the region live in peace. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Karaj.
Families of prisoners and their advocates staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and detention centers, including more than 500 administrative detainees. Palestinian administrative detainees have been boycotting Israeli regime courts for more than 5 months to protest their administrative detention. Administrative detention is incarceration without trial or charge and has no time limit.
Administrative detainees are subjected to extreme suffering inside Israeli jails. They've been boycotting Israeli courts for more than 150 days to protest the detention without charge. Administrative detention is a racist policy and only causes pain and suffering to Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are being denied basic rights. Since the beginning of this year, Israeli regime forces have arrested some 3,000 Palestinians, including children and women.
Administrative detention is a systematic policy by the Israeli regime to hold Palestinian prisoners behind bars without trial for a very long time. Administrative detention can be renewed indefinitely, and it inflicts psychological pressure on the prisoners. We have all suffered from administrative detention inside Israeli jails.
During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Ministry of Detainees Affairs slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
We call on all international human rights organizations to come out of their silence and exert pressure on the Israeli regime to stop the inhumane administrative detention policy. Palestinian prisoners are freedom fighters and must be treated according to international laws and norms. The Israeli regime is violating conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
According to Palestinian prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Most of these detainees have been held with no charge or trial. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Russia is currently pounding the Donbass with its overwhelming air and artillery superiority. On the ground, Ukrainian soldiers post videos on social media from underneath the barrage. With each passing day, the odds of these soldiers surviving dwindles, as President Zelensky today made the staggering statement that between 60 and 100 Ukrainian soldiers are dying every day, with another 500 wounded.
As this conflict began, many voices around the world said that it was NATO's plan to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. Well, many Ukrainian units now are refusing to head into the hellstorm that is currently the Donbass, and as they say, to face certain death.
In an underreported phenomenon, in the last week I've seen more than half a dozen videos posted by Ukrainian units in which they declare they are refusing to fight. They say they are not being adequately trained or equipped, that their commanders are not going with them, and that they are being used as cannon fodder. This is the 115th Brigade. After refusing to fight, they were arrested for desertion. I have also seen videos of women in Ukraine protesting the predicament of their sons and husbands.
The Ukrainian armed forces can largely be categorized into three separate groups. First of all, you have the far-right, in some cases neo-Nazi militias, who do have some influence over Ukrainian politics, but are also ideologically driven to fight the Russians. You then have the well-trained Ukrainian soldiers, often trained in NATO countries, who are also, judging by various social media posts, bolstered, their ranks being bolstered by foreign mercenaries, in particular some former special forces fighters of NATO countries. They, of course, are highly trained and highly motivated. Then you have the National Guard, who are largely conscripted from the reserves. They are not very well trained. They haven't had fight experience, and they're far less motivated to fight. It's from these groups that these posted videos are coming from.
Yeah. Eduard Basurin, the deputy commander of the Donetsk People's Republic, who are fighting alongside the Russians.
The situation in Ukraine was being developed for one thing, to destabilize the Russian Federation. They are interested in this destabilization lasting for as long as possible, hoping that the citizens of Russian Federation will get tired. That's why they are interested in fighting to the last Ukrainian. So I have pity for the people in Ukraine. They are being eliminated, and I don't see the end of it. It's a big tragedy.
An apartment in Odessa. Military summons are plastered all over it. And here, another summons. In order to make up for their huge losses, Ukraine is increasingly calling up its reserves. And since the beginning of Russia's invasion, men of military age are not allowed to leave the country. While Ukrainian government propaganda relentlessly claims that the fight for Donbass is worth it, many Ukrainians would rather live in peace, even if it means territorial concessions. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Meeting in Brussels, EU leaders have agreed to place an embargo on 75% of Russian oil imports, increasing to 90% by the end of the year. 4 weeks ago, Moscow cut off gas supplies to EU countries Poland and Bulgaria. Now Russian gas to energy firms in Netherlands, Denmark and Germany is being switched off. EU leaders say they won't back down and will continue to send arms to Ukraine.
Since the beginning of the war, leaders and the member states stepped up and announced by now 200 billion euros in extra military spending.
It is clear that most citizens don't support the move.
We are still just
speaking about sanctions, giving arms and stuff. We need to speak about peace and diplomacy.
I'm against spending more and more money for weapons, because that is only going to end up in more conflict, because the only purpose of weapons is to use them against somebody else.
Amid criticism from US war hawks, German and French leaders have been defending their decision to keep lines of communication open with the Kremlin.
I do endorse discussing with Vladimir Putin on a regular basis, with very demanding approach and full transparency with President Zelensky.
Many analysts suggest the West created this crisis by not listening to Russia's security concerns, and apparent efforts to reach out to Moscow recently are merely a charade. EU leaders have now returned to their capitals, but senior officials here at the European Commission have told Press TV that work is well underway on a seventh round of sanctions targeting Russia. Peace activists continue to ask the question, why does all the emphasis seem to be on escalation rather than diplomacy? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For the first time since the presidential vote, France's unions marched nationwide, as the nation's public services will likely be under major attack for the next 5 years. Polls show President Emmanuel Macron will likely have almost as strong a grip over parliament as in his first term.
Unions repeatedly warned that the coronavirus was being instrumentalized to accelerate the long-standing neoliberal goal of defunding public services. Now they face a re-elected Macron who could be more powerful and confrontational than ever.
Macron's policies have meant the ending of so many social services and not replacing public servants who retire. This means those still working are doing double the amount of work as before, and that has led to burnout, illness, and even suicide attempts. If Macron would come talk to us, he would see that we are not being treated fairly, but I doubt he will.
New data shows the French economy has stagnated to the brink of a recession. Inflation in the Eurozone just hit its highest annual level since the currency began in 1999. That combination spells stagflation, something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy, and it comes after a decade of austerity measures which were allegedly supposed to strengthen the Eurozone.
The inflation index point has not been changed in a decade for civil servants, so our salaries have been constantly falling, and this was before this year's record increase in inflation. On top of this, they are asking us to work longer for the same pay, so our hourly wage is being reduced and we have less time away from work to be with our family and friends.
Despite the new lows in economic data, unions were not able to draw as many to march as in years past. Since the coronavirus restrictions began to be lifted last fall, many have noted that French protests are occurring less often and are smaller in size. It could be that, after a decade of mostly failed labor efforts, workers simply can't afford to miss work anymore. Or many have given up trying to influence Brussels or the French government. Or many French could be too scared to protest given what happened to the Yellow Vests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The British Parliament is in recess, but the letters are coming in. Only a week after a damning report by Sue Gray into Downing Street parties and Chancellor Rishi Sunak's £15 billion to help with the soaring cost of living.
The high command of the Conservative Party are in operation distraction now, with handouts, with talk about the Ukraine war, and many other things too. But the party is currently in operation frustration. They elected Boris Johnson to be a great asset when it came to winning votes. At the moment, he's losing them votes.
So far this week, three more letters of no confidence, including one from former Attorney General Jeremy Wright, who said that with regret he concluded that for the good of this and future governments, the Prime Minister should step down. 37 MPs have now publicly questioned the Prime Minister's position. Out of those, two don't think he should go yet, eight are on the fence, and 27 want him to go now.
For a vote of no confidence to take place, 54 Conservative MPs will have to request it. But it's impossible to know exactly how many of them have already handed in their letters of no confidence because it's all done in secret. And some MPs are saying they're going to wait until after the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, celebrated this week, before they decide if Boris Johnson has to resign.
There isn't a clear successor to him that might bring them electoral advantage. And while they talk about the Jubilee, let's wait after that, they mentioned the same thing about the Sue Gray report, about the police inquiry. In reality, they're waiting to see if this finally dies down or if this is a chronic condition, like malaria rather than COVID, that never goes away. And if it doesn't go away for Boris, then Boris is going to have to go away from the Conservatives.
There is also a question mark over what went down during COVID lockdowns in the Prime Minister's private apartment at the time. Allegations of another gathering on the day of Boris Johnson's birthday. But all eyes will be on the outcome of the upcoming by-elections beyond London, following the resignations of two disgraced Conservative MPs. Wakefield MP Imran Ahmed Khan, found guilty of sexually assaulting a teenage boy in 2008, and Tiverton and Honiton MP Neil Parish for watching pornography in Parliament. If the Tories lose, a ballot on Johnson's leadership is almost certain. Saeed Pourreza, London.
In the limelight.
This isn't just some corporate takeover, said one critic, adding, this is about a set of very specific moves that oligarchs have been taking that have gradually concentrated economic, political, and discursive power in fewer and fewer hands. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, A Real Threat to Democracy. Musk buys Twitter for $44 billion. Here's the details. April 25, 2022, rights advocates, public health experts, and media critics were among those who warned that the purchase of Twitter by mega-billionaire Elon Musk, the world's richest person, creates a direct threat to democracy and the common good by putting the outsized power of the social media platform used by hundreds of millions worldwide into the hands of one man. The social media company accepted Musk's offer to purchase Twitter for $44 billion, or $54.20 per share, leading some critics to note other ways the enormous sum of money could have been spent rather than on what Representative Chai Garcia called the vanity project boondoggle to silence Musk's critics. Tax the rich, Garcia said on Twitter. Musk's purchase has led to concern that former President Donald Trump's Twitter account will be reinstated. Trump was banned from the platform in January 2021 after violating its rules by inciting his followers to violently attack the U.S. Capitol in an effort to stop the certification of the 2020 presidential election results. Musk hasn't just purchased another expensive Play Toy, but a global online community that includes about 330 million regular users, said Jessica Gonzalez, co-CEO of Free Press, adding, with control of such a massive platform comes great responsibility, and Musk hasn't shown he has the capacity to be accountable to this diverse online community.
She added, noting Musk's own history of using Twitter to intimidate and disparage others, including journalists, elected officials, owners of competing businesses, and anyone else who might challenge his views. With Musk at the helm, Gonzalez said Twitter must improve its content moderation practices and stop amplifying bigotry and conspiracy theories that pollute public discourse, threaten the health and safety of users, and undermine democracy. Musk has criticized Twitter's efforts to moderate the platform, saying early this month that he believes it's just really important that people have the reality and the perception that they are able to speak freely within the bounds of the law, and that the civilizational risk is decreased the more we can increase the trust of Twitter as a public platform. Journalist Anand Giridharas said that by taking over Twitter and claiming he will protect the platform as the digital town square where matters vital to the future of humanity are debated, Musk is doing is what plutocrats have been doing, branding themselves the solution to the very problem they are. This isn't just some corporate takeover, he said, adding, this is about a set of very specific moves that oligarchs have been taking that have gradually concentrated economic, political, and discursive power in fewer and fewer hands. As Media Matters reported recently, right-wing politicians in the U.S. have been in favor of Musk's purchase since he first offered to buy the platform earlier this month. Representative Jim Jordan led 18 House Republicans in writing to Twitter's board of directors demanding that the board preserve all records related to Musk's bid. The rights propagandist had celebrated Musk's bid as a way to garner political gain by ending the company's purported political censorship, reported senior fellow Matt Gertz, adding, then its elected GOP champions, responding to hesitation from and when Twitter's board raised the prospect of a costly congressional investigation if his offer wasn't accepted. While Twitter was a large and powerful company before Musk's takeover was announced, said Sana Said of Al Jazeera, the purchase does underscore an unnerving trend. The ability of a single man to purchase something that impacts hundreds of millions beyond users in order to influence it in its own image. It's less than great when billionaires own sports teams, which bind communities together as their playthings, said Robert Weisman, president of consumer advocacy group Public Citizen, adding, having a billionaire own Twitter, a vital platform for communication and community, as his plaything is far more serious. It's a real threat to democracy.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The spotlight. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to Iran's Vienna talks, lots of advancements were made to the point that some thought that a deal was imminent. Now the latest news is that the United States, France, Britain and Germany are pushing for the IAEA to rebuke Iran for failing to answer long-standing questions. Iran has said that it will respond in a strong and appropriate manner to any unconstructive action at the upcoming IAEA Board of Governors meeting. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why things are looking so different now and the chances that a draft resolution will be submitted at the next Board of Governors meeting. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition joins us from San Francisco. Also joining us is Robert Fantina. He's an author, journalist, and activist who joins us from Kitchener. All right, welcome to you both. Richard Becker, I'll start with you. There was a time not too long ago that we were looking at potential breakthrough because of the way that things were being presented. Things like 90% of the way is achieved, we just have a few remaining outstanding issues. And now we're looking at how the U.S., France, Britain, and Germany are pushing for the IAEA to rebuke in a strong and appropriate manner Iran, saying that it's going to respond. And this is on the Board of Governors meeting for a resolution to perhaps be leveled against Iran. Why do you think things have changed so dramatically?
I think that we have to look at who the personnel are who are now running U.S. foreign policy. And that would include, in addition to the president, most importantly, his national security advisor, Sullivan, the person who's in charge of the Indo-Pac region, that's Kurt Campbell, the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, and a number of others who really come from the Hillary Clinton era State Department, who rose to prominence in that period, and who are really neocons, very hawkish neocons. And they have become much more hawkish since the war in Ukraine began. Their intervention, the U.S. intervention that they are directing in the war, which is prolonging the war, making the war ever more deadly and ever more dangerous of escalation. I think we have to see that in connection to other aspects of U.S. foreign policy, key aspects of U.S. foreign policy. So we have this heightened hostility and belligerence toward Iran, toward China, of course, toward Russia. But I think that these are all tied together, and that the what the objective is of this foreign policy group is to reestablish and carry out, they hope, the objective of the U.S. being the dominant power, the sole dominant power in the world. And this means an even more hostile and belligerent attitude toward what are perceived of as their enemies, or they perceive as their enemies. They're not the enemies of the people of the United States, I want to say that, but they perceive them to be anyone who stands in the way of that objective of U.S. global domination.
Yeah, but there's certain aspects of this Board of Governors meeting that's upcoming, Robert Fantina, that we need to talk about that turning the table against Iran. For example, when it comes to the issue of stockpile, the quarterly IAEA report is saying that Iran has exceeded its, limit by more than, it says, 18 times. But, things have to be put into perspective. Iran's permanent representative to the international organization, IAEA, has said that that's one-sided and that it fails to reflect Iran's extensive cooperation when it comes to the IAEA. Why is the IAEA being swayed in this direction? We know in the way that IAEA presents its facts, or not even present it, depending on how it sees it, obviously it could influence countries like the U.S., the ones that are party to the Vienna talks.
Yes, and it works the other way around also. The United States influences that, the agency itself, the atomic agency. And we have to also look at the Israeli connection. Israel is accusing Iran of deception, of lying, going back and looking at documents that date back to 2002.
Okay, looks like...
all kinds of different things.
Go ahead. No. For a second, you were frozen. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yes, but there are many things to look at here. It wasn't Iran that violated JCPOA. So if Iran is enriching its uranium to a higher level, it's within its rights to do so. The JCPOA ceased to exist when the U.S. Withdrew from it. Now, the United States, France, Germany are pressuring the Atomic Agency to criticize, to find something, to find fault with in Iran so that the JCPOA can be seen or viewed by the United States as having failed, not due to U.S. actions, but due to Iranian actions, which is a complete lie. But this is what we're seeing now today. The United States is trying to maneuver the Atomic Energy Agency to find some criticism of Iran so that the United States can act in some way, possibly that off the table, because the United States doesn't believe in diplomacy. It only believes in force. And this is, as your other commentator mentioned, this is all part of the United States trying to reinforce its worldwide domination. This is being opposed by many nations, Iran being just one of them. But the United States will fight hard to re-achieve that.
So here we have a second report also, Richard Becker, and we need to break this down a little bit, of which you're having the IAEA, for example, highlight the fact that Iran is not giving a sufficient explanation regarding traces of uranium. You have the representative to the IAEA who has said that Iran's civilian nuclear program is carried out under the auspices of not only the IAEA in terms of the monitoring, but also Iran is carrying out its work within the framework of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or the NPT. And that within that framework, its legal obligations are being carried out. So again, it puts into question the motive that the IAEA has, or the IAEA chief, I should say, in the way that it's presenting its report. Again, what is influencing the IAEA to steer in that direction?
Well, it's all a question of power, and I think that that's true. But there's been a shift. We should see the shift that's taken place where Germany, France, Britain, but particularly Germany and France, I think, have much more aligned themselves with the U.S. in global foreign policy through NATO since the beginning of the Ukraine war. There were a lot of differences leading up to that. But it's essentially the domination of the United States. And, we have these stories that come out, like your other guest referred to, the documents that really turned out to be documents from 2004, 2006, that they're trying to portray as the Israeli intelligence, Mossad, is trying to portray as that's what's going on now, that those documents prove what they're asserting is going on now. We have no way to really know about any of this, and so many times in the past, these assertions, these allegations, turn out to have been completely fabricated. I mean, this has been going on for a long, long time. It's not anything new. But I think that we can see that if we look objectively at the record, that Iran met all the conditions of the JCPOA. And the IAEA at that time was reporting on a regular basis that Iran was meeting all the requirements. But the U.S. then broke the treaty, as the U.S. government has broken so many other treaties, unilaterally broke that treaty. And then the U.S. allies, the European powers that were part of the JCPOA, said to Iran, don't break the agreement, stay with the agreement, keep meeting your requirements, and we'll find some way to get around the sanctions. And then that never happened. that never took place. So the responsibility, the blame for this crisis rests firmly with Washington, and the answer to try to move forward also lies there. If the U.S. wants to move this process forward, it'll move forward. If they don't want to move it forward, it appears that they're able to put this pressure on the IAEA along with its allies to come up with ways to block the reinstatement of the JCPOA.
It needs to be mentioned, Robert Fintina, the fact that the agency, based on what Iran has said, would not have any access to that memory information of its cameras. And other information in that regard, Iran made it clear. Iran said that until an agreement is reached for the revival of the JCPOA, that information is not going to be released. Let's move on to some of the fabrications leveled by Israel, in this case in point, just recently by the Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, and break that down a little bit here. Just recently, a couple of days back, I guess, documents Naftali Bennett came on and said were taken from Iran, showing Iranian intelligence, according to what he was saying, spied on the UN's Atomic Energy Agency in order to better cover up what he said was Iran's rogue nuclear activities. And he said, so how do we know this? Iran stole this classified documents and used that information to systematically, I'm using his words, to evade nuclear probes. This is what he wrote on Twitter. First of all, what do you think when he comes out and says that?
Well, there are many things there. One is he's criticizing Iran's nuclear program when Bennett and previous Israeli governments have denied their own nuclear program and haven't offered any kind of transparency about it whatsoever. And that is an apartheid regime that is involved in some of the most heinous war crimes and crimes against humanity on a daily basis. So Bennett is in no position to be criticizing Iran or anyone else. Also, we have to look at how Mossad got these documents, these alleged documents. It stole them from the IAEA. And as both Mr. Becker and I have mentioned, these documents go back as much as 18 years. They are not current. They don't cover the time immediately preceding, during, or after the JCPOA. So they're, even if they're legitimate, and there's it's highly questionable whether or not they are irrelevant to today's, what's happening today. However, Bennett and the all Israeli government and the U.S. government will seize upon them, look for some way of criticizing Iran and giving the United States a means that it will perceive as legitimate, but it certainly isn't, to not reinstate the JCPOA. The U.S. violated the JCPOA, broke the treaty. It is up to U.S. to unilaterally re-enter it. The U.S. has refused to do that. And these documents that Bennett is saying are so important to the future of any agreement with Iran are simply not valid in this situation.
Okay, this is the part, Richard Becker, that needs to be pointed out to. I mean, if anybody's following the story and just reads, and I'm going to refer to what I'm about to say, Richard Becker, to an Israeli publication that has cited this. It says the files were part of a cache allegedly stolen. I'm sorry, it was a slip. Allegedly taken by Israeli agents, because the publication is saying that, from an Iranian warehouse in the year 2018. Okay? So my question is, if these were taken in the year 2018, why does Naftali Bennett have to wait until now, this moment, to come out and say what it's saying? I mean, it doesn't take really a rocket scientist to figure this out in terms of looking through the statements and seeing where the you know, what word can be used, where the deception is or where the falsification is. What do you think about that, about the date of when this was taken and the revelation, so to speak, by Naftali Bennett?
Well, of course, they're using the stolen information, with whatever it may be, whatever it actually may be, but they've been waiting for some moment to bring it out and or to allege that this is what it says. And I want to keep emphasizing that we really can have no confidence in what this material is. But it's clearly being done from a tactical point of view, in the way of Israel trying to block a return to the JCPOA. And Israel has played this role, but it cannot play this role effectively without being granted the right to do so by Washington. And this is one of the, so I think that we can see that there's some shift that's taken place in Washington, where it did look, as you said at the top of the show, like it was moving toward an agreement and just, you know, a few details to work out, until now when it looks like the direction is the opposite, that it's moving further and further away from a new agreement. That's not to say that it can't happen. Other developments in the world can weigh in on this. But right now, it looks like, you know, the shift is on, and the shift would not be on unless in Washington, in the administration, there was a desire to prevent the agreement from being reinstated, or a similar agreement being reached.
Well, Robert Fantina, it's not the first time that we heard about Israel lying or fabricating or using false information, because I have to say it in that manner and use those words, because Bennett comes out and says, quote, Iran lied to the world. Iran is lying to the world again right now, and the world must make sure that Iran doesn't get away scot-free. I'm sure you can cite, or almost anyone can cite, different ways that Israel has lied about Iran. Nobody, I'm sure, can forget the way that the former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came on the stand at the UN and brought up that cardboard picture with the magic marker drawing. Nobody can forget that Iran is just a short time away from getting or obtaining a nuclear bomb. There are other incidents, Netanyahu with the full Hollywood-style display about the Ahmad, Project Ahmad, as he called it. Or we can talk about how it also made allegations against Iran. Actually, going back to the year 1996, Netanyahu had every opportunity practically he had leveling these types of accusations. Why does Israeli statements even have an audience and for even an agency like an IAEA to take it into account?
It's only because the United States is ordering the IAEA to do so. You mentioned Netanyahu and his picture of the bomb. I documented a couple of years ago how many times Netanyahu or other Israeli leaders said that the government of Iran was a couple of months away from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Repeatedly over the years, they have lied about this. It's also Israel that is assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists and denying culpability. It's Israel that is repeatedly committing crimes against humanity, saying it's doing it in the name of its national security. The credibility of the Israeli government is non-existent. However, the United States is powerful enough still to coerce organizations such as the United Nations and its various departments to appear to give credibility to what Israel says. It's simply coming from the United States, and any other government leaders must look at this and think, how are they going to pretend that these statements are reasonable, but they must do so or experience the wrath of the United States.
One of the things that's confusing, Richard Becker, about the Israeli stance of going all out, trying to prevent from any type of agreement on this issue to come into fruition, is the fact that they are under the impression that Iran has its hands cut off when it comes to revenues. And Iran has said that, you know, these sanctions, we're still making our money when it comes to oil sales. Iran has said that. They have found Iran has been under sanctions for decades. They know their way around sanctions. And in a more general sense, that's a message to the U.S., where under this so-called maximum pressure policy, it has failed. The U.S. has even said that. Why does Israel think that it has to go all out, thinking it's going to cut off the money supply of Iran by going after this Vienna talks and its failure, that it's so adamant about doing it and going after it?
Well, I think it's clear that Israel has been hoping that there would be a war against Iran, a war that would severely weaken Iran, I mean, I don't think that's about to happen, but I think that's what they want. And I think it's been clear that that's what they wanted. And they wanted a bigger war, you know, not just Israel against Iran, but, you know, for the U.S. to come into the war. And Israel's aim is to be the dominant regional power. Of course, they have to do that in conjunction with the U.S. And it's not, you know, the Turkey is also a regional power. But they see, Israel sees Iran as its number one contender or enemy in terms of who's the dominant power in the region. And the U.S. is very much involved in this, too. There's the resistance bloc that exists in the region, which is opposed to imperialist domination and to Israel. And the U.S. and Israel and some of the other U.S. allies consistently are seeking to weaken that resistance bloc in order to dominate the region as a whole, the U.S. and Israel. So I think that that's the reality. And the other thing about this is that it's just so fundamentally dishonest is that the NPT proliferation treaty says that the nuclear power, in addition to it's always invoked to talk about countries that might be developing nuclear weapons that aren't supposed to under that. But the other part of it is that the nuclear weapons states are supposed to be disarming. And the United States is in the midst of a multi-trillion-dollar, 10-year project to upgrade, quote-unquote, improve its nuclear weapons. They are in complete defiance every day of the NPT.
And that includes Israel. My final question, Robert Fatina, is that Iran has come out and said the Israeli regime is the world's number one JCPOA hater, happens to be the NPT denier. This is the foreign ministry that came out, as a spokesperson, that is, who said this. And the only nuke possessor of the MENA region. We know this. The world knows this. Time for the E3 U.S. to stop pretending to be asleep. And he rounds off his statements by saying they can pursue diplomacy or pursue the opposite. We're ready for both. What do you think the opposite is, based on how he sees it?
Well, the opposite, of course, is war at its extreme. And the United States or Israel would be extremely foolish to go to war with Iran. Iran is a powerful country. It has powerful allies. This would not be an easy war. It would not be a quick war. It would be extremely deadly and devastating for much of the world. The JCPOA benefited Iran very much, but as was mentioned earlier, Iran has lived with sanctions and will continue to do so. But the government of Israel does hate the JCPOA. Benjamin Netanyahu, as prime minister, spoke to the U.S. Congress.
Very well. Thank you. We're fresh out of time. I'm sorry about that.
Thank you.
Robert Fantina. Right. I apologize. Robert Fantina there, author, journalist, and activist from Kitchener. Richard Becker, thank you so much from the Answer Coalition, who spoke to us from San Francisco.